Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I usually do not lecture in the evenings at the George Washington University. I do not lecture during the day, that's enough. But this is an exceptional occasion. I always try to do what the Muslim students ask me to do to the extent that I can. And they said there were a lot of people who wanted to come if I could speak in the evening. And I said, all right, good pleasure. Usually, God is kind, and when, even when I'm tired, I receive an energy when to be able to speak. And tonight, I'm exceptionally tired out, but I'm very glad to be able to discuss with you what is perhaps the most important issue for humanity today, outside of our relationship with God, which is absolutely a crucial issue. And that is the issue of the environment. And the topic, the title of my topic is Reading the Cosmic Quran. That's the technical topic of it, but that's an opening for discussing the Islamic understanding of religion, Islamic religion, as it envisages man, the human being, men and women, and the natural environment, God's creation. This is also the Islam Awareness Week. I see a lot of people who are present here. In fact, they're Muslim students themselves. Of course, some non-Muslim students from the university and elsewhere. But I want to emphasize that Islam Awareness Week should not only be an occasion for others to know about Islam, but also for Muslims to become aware of their own tradition, especially students, many of whom have been given by God the faith to cling to Islam, but not the knowledge to understand all its different dimensions. And the whole question of our relation with the environment can only find a solution in the deeper understanding of Islamic intellectual tradition, of course, the inner meaning of the Quran with which this tradition deals. One might ask, what is the use of speaking about the Islamic view of man and the environment when the pollution in Karachi and Tehran and Cairo are what they are? You have to cut it with a pair of scissors to be able to walk. And that there's so little attention paid in the Islamic world today to this issue. Whenever a political situation is created, like I said, the election in Pakistan recently, no one speaks about the environment as if it were non-issue. Of course, very tragically, this is also true of the United States, the country more responsible than any other country in the world for the destruction of the environment, because of its excessive usage through consumerism of resources which are destroying ecosystems very far away. But not a word is said about what is without doubt the most important earthly issue of our generation, and it's the generation survives of the next generation. So I believe that despite what appears on the surface, that is a certain amount of indifference that one sees in the non-Western world towards this issue, and even in the Western world itself when it comes to serious discussions like we're having right now, nonetheless, it's very, very important to pay attention to this matter. And I'm very glad to say that during the last 40, 50 years in the Islamic world, interest in this issue has risen a great deal. When I first gave the Rockefeller Series lectures at the University of Chicago, in 1966, in the spring of 1966, which was the first work that predicted not only the environmental crisis on this state, on this scale, but also the spiritual reasons for it. Very few people in the Islamic world were interested. In fact, when the book came out as Man and Nature, I was then a very, very well-known scholar in the Islamic world. All my other works were then translated very quickly into Urdu, Turkish, well, Persian was my mother tongue, was living in Iran at that time. But except this book, this was the one book that received the least amount of attention, except in the one country in the Islamic world where secularism was the most extensive, that is in Turkey. In all the other parts of the Islamic world, this has been the last of my books, and also the book Religion and the Order of Nature, which was the Cadre lecture I delivered the same issue in a more extensive way in 1966 in Birmingham University in England. The last of my works to be translated and read. But despite all of this, there's a lot more interest now in this issue in the Islamic world, but not very much deep understanding of what is really involved. It is true that the many people now are studying Islamic law, the Sharia as it pertains to the protection of animals and plants and the environment, as I come to, back to that at the end of the lecture. But there are very few people who pay attention to what is really involved, which is not only a legal matter, but it's a spiritual matter. It's our vision of the nature of reality. And one of the reasons for that is the great tragedy that has befallen the Islamic world. That is the spread of a scientism, which in a very shallow way equates modern Western science with knowledge as expressed in the Quran. We're totally impervious to the fact that you can be an atheist and win the Nobel Prize in physics, which means God is irrelevant to modern science. Totally irrelevant. And any Muslim student who thinks otherwise does not understand either modern science or Islam. But everywhere in the Islamic world, from the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is their Islamic government supposedly, to Saudi Arabia, which is at the other pole, you might say, of the political spectrum, and every country in between, whether you're in Pakistan or Malaysia or Indonesia or Central Asia or Africa and Senegal, in the Arab world, Persian world, Malay world, doesn't make a difference, Indonesian world, everywhere there is this so-called scientism, which in fact many people take pride in because they think this is the way to be able to be good Muslims and also to swallow the modern view of natural world. There are some seats available here. If I'm standing up, it's because I have to. You people don't have to stand up. Suffer doubly, both listening to me and standing up is too much. God will not be pleased with that. There are some seats here also. Come and sit down. I have a lot to say about this issue. It's a very difficult issue to speak about. It has over 150 years of history in the Islamic world. From the end of the 19th century, when first in Egypt and then other countries, people began to write so-called scientific commentaries upon the Quran, what is called a tafsir al-ilmi. A man called Iskandarani from Alexandria, obviously, wrote a voluminous work of many, many volumes, just called that. And one work after another came out. And almost all major so-called Islamic reformers, in whom I do not have very much confidence, I usually make a joke and say most of the Islamic reformers were Islamic deformers, but they thought they were reformers. They fell into this trap. Sir Syed Ahmad Khan, the founder of modern Islamic education in India, wrote an incredible commentary upon the Quran in which it commented upon and gave an exegetical view of verses on the basis of the science of the day. And that's in the 19th century that science has been completely overturned by data discoveries, and it seems absurd that all these verses of the Quran are interpreted in such a way that no longer have any significance. This disease, of course, is not only in the Islamic world, it's just as strong in the Hindu world, and of course in China, where it has its apogee because it's not even a religious government, it's a Marxist regime. But the idea that science is somehow equated with the traditional ways in which people look upon the world is not only an Islamic problem, but it's all over the world, non-Western world. And the reasons for that are very profound, and I will not get into it. That's not the subject of my discourse. What I want to say is that in order to understand the Islamic view of the Quran and the relationship between human beings and the natural world, one has to cast aside this whole way of looking at modern science as simply what the Quran asked us to learn about the world of nature. There are very few voices in the Islamic world today which have the audacity to speak about this. I just came up with a book recently that has already caused a great deal of commotion in many Islamic countries called Islam, Science, Muslims and Technology, which is very, very critical of this pseudoscientism by people who know neither modern science nor their own intellectual Islamic tradition in depth. And one of my very best former students, a professor now, is a leading professor in this field, William Chittick, has also written a book on this precisely, on the cosmos as seen traditionally and seen according to modern ways of looking at things. The modern way of looking at nature, the modern scientific way, is what has led to the environmental crisis. It is true that people say science is neutral, but it's not neutral. To look upon the universe as being simply a mechanical or mechanistic reality, which was what came out of the 17th century scientific revolution, or even its destruction in modern physics by quantum mechanics and relativity and so forth, nevertheless function within a purely quantitative view of nature, which sees our spiritual relationship to nature to be irrelevant. The presence of God to be totally irrelevant. As Laplace told Napoleon, he said, we no longer need the God hypothesis. The famous mathematical astronomer, Laplace, this was the answer when Napoleon told him, what happens to God? He said, we no longer need that hypothesis. That's exactly what it is. And the fact that the great religions of the world have not paid attention to this is itself to deny humanity the only remedy for this fatal disease of which we are all suffering. The difference between Christianity and other religions is that the other religions were not aware of all that was going on in Western science until quite recently. Whereas, of course, Christianity was, and Christianity gave up the cosmos in the 17th century already, after the Galileo trial in many ways. Practically no Catholic theologian wrote on the theology of nature after that, and very few Protestants ever wrote on the subject. Protestantism was acosmic, as I've said oftentimes. But in Islam, these traditions continue right up to our own day, and they have not died out. And what I'm going to discuss today is precisely how to read the Quran as a cosmic text, as a text that is related to the structure of the cosmos. Not at all as predicting that this verse corresponds to the discovery of the microbe by Louis Pasteur and this other verse by what John Boyle said about chemistry. This, I think, is total nonsense. And it's really degrading to the Word of God that we would have to need to send a revelation for us to discover that water is made of oxygen and hydrogen. I'm one of the people who stands extremely opposed to this point of view, and it's almost half a century now. When I first began to speak against this, and I haven't changed my view one iota. So what I'm going to talk about is not this kind of understanding of the Quran, but how for 14 centuries Islam understood, and still many people who are not touched by the scientism understand the significance of the Quran as a cosmic text in relationship to our understanding of nature as human beings. Now, there are certain key ideas which need to be discussed. Many of you who are Muslim students know that one of the names of the Quran is Umm al-Kitab. The structure in Arabic, for those of you who not know Arabic, now has become popular through the mother of all battles, which took place in Iraq in 1991, and is entered into the English language somewhat. But the expression in Arabic, which means mother of something, means the source, the principle, the origin, in the same way that we are born from our mother's body. Umm al-Kitab is one of the names of the Quran, which can be translated the mother book, but it can also be called the archetypal book. It is the archetype of all sacred scripture. And that Umm al-Kitab is not only this Quran that we have in our hands or I have in my pocket, it is in God's knowledge, it's an intelligible reality, which is the principle of the Quran as we know it and other sacred texts, the Quran refers to that the word of God was manifested in other languages and other ways and now comes out as the Quran. And one of the very important commentators of the Quran 900 years ago wrote that it's the same Umm al-Kitab, the same word of God, which when it was expressed in Hebrew became known as the Torah, and so forth, and now expressed in Arabic, and it's known as the Quran. So the Quran is Umm al-Kitab. But Umm al-Kitab also means the principle of the cosmos. That is, what is the principle of the written Quran is also the principle of the cosmos. And the distinction that was made traditionally throughout much of the Islamic intellectual history between what was called the written Quran Quran al Tadwini, the word Tadwin meaning to put together in a book, but that one. And the cosmic Quran, al Quran al Takwini, is very, very significant. That is, the Muslims saw the Quran revealed to the Prophet of Islam, as complementing the primordial revelation of God, which is the cosmos. In a sense, the world of nature, and cosmos in a larger sense, is the first revelation, and the Quran the last revelation of God. And these two are related through the common archetype, which is the Ummul Kitab. And therefore, it was perfectly understood why the Quran itself refers to its verses as signs of God, ayah. The word ayah means a verse of the Quran. Some Muslims who do not know English well always say, why do you use the word verse? They think verse means verse of poetry and the Quran said not poetry. Of course, it doesn't mean that. It's like the verse of the Bible or the verse of the Torah or the Bhagavad Gita or anything else. It means the one sentence of the Quran is called an ayah. And the phenomena of nature also called ayah. And the phenomena within the soul are called ayah. So you have this three-way relationship between the Quran and the cosmos itself, divided into the macrocosmic reality and the microcosmic reality. And this is explicitly mentioned in the famous verse of the Quran, that we shall show them our signs within themselves and upon the horizons until it becomes certain unto them that it is the truth. سَنُّرِهُمْ آيَاتِنَا فِي الْآفَاقِ وَفِي أَنفُسَهِمْ. I don't want to quote too much Arabic here because I'm sure many people do not know any Arabic at all, but that's all right. For those who do, this one verse, it says, سَنُّرِهُمْ آيَاتِنَا, we shall show them our signs. I don't like the word sign completely because in modern English, the word sign is something agreed upon by human beings, like a traffic sign. Whereas here the word ayah means a divine symbol. I much prefer to use the word symbol for ayah. But in this sense, that is, God reveals his portents, the signs that lead to him in the sense of symbol, within afaq, that is, in the cosmos, and within the soul of people, until it becomes known unto them that it is the truth. So the Quran itself asserts a principial relationship between our inner being, the cosmos, and the divine reality, which is intelligible reality in God's mind, God's intellect, and the law, knowledge with God, that are related together in this existential way, and they're inseparable. That is also the key why we can know the world, according to traditional metaphysics. Why is it you can make a statement about some galaxy far away? There must be some kind of relationship. And that relationship is metaphysically what I express for you from the Islamic point of view. There's a sentence of the great German poet and also philosopher Goethe, who was very much interested in Islamic thought, which is very, very telling. He says, how can the eye see the sun unless there already be the sun in the eye? Something of the sun has to be in our eyes in order to see the sun. And the fact that we can know the world, the fact we can destroy the world, the fact that we are the only creatures on earth who can destroy God's creation is precisely because we are the central reflection of those ayat of God, those portents of God, which constitute the meaning of all phenomena. In a sense, every phenomenon of nature has its counterpart within us. And therefore, the destruction of nature, which we're carrying out, really begins with the pollution within us, the destruction of the inner landscape. When over 40 years ago I mentioned that, everybody would attack me, but now of course many people have written about this, and Theodore Roszak, who's one of the most perceptive American writers on this issue, who wrote Where the Wasteland Ends and Animal and Planet and all these books, The Unfinished Animal, he continued the subject, the basis of what I said. Now many other people have said it also, that precisely because there's a relationship, human beings would not have destroyed nature had they not forgotten who they were. That is, had not these ayats within us become eclipsed by this culture of forgetfulness, which constitutes the modern world. modern Zen, in a sense, is based on the forgetfulness of the divine. Not that everybody becomes an atheist, that one still goes to church on Sunday mornings or Saturday to synagogue, but we live in such a way that the signs of God are no longer relevant to our everyday existence, and that is really the cause of the environmental crisis. Let me turn back to another very important issue. All sacred scripture is directly or indirectly related to the cosmology, to a view of the cosmos. Now you must say, what about the New Testament? In the New Testament, there's practically no reference to cosmic reality. Very, very little. But the New Testament is not the only Christian sacred scripture. The Old Testament and the New Testament together constitute the Bible. And for traditional Christianity, the cosmological teachings came from the Old Testament. Not only from the book of Genesis, but other parts of the Old Testament. So every sacred scripture refers to nature and to the cosmos in which we live in one way or another. The Upanishads, the Avesta, of course the Abrahamic texts, the Tao Te Ching, and so forth and so on. Of all the sacred scriptures of the world, none speaks about nature as much as does the Quran. If you count the number of verses in the Quran which concern nature, they're more than the verses that concern Islamic law. They're more, numerically speaking, which is very interesting. Nobody pays attention to that. The Quran keeps coming back to the participation of the creatures of this world, of God's creation in the Quranic revelation. First of all, God in many verses swears by various things. Atina wa zaytun. He swears by the olive, by the fig, mentions pomegranates, mentions the stars, Najm, and the trees, Shajara, and the sun, and the moon. And not only are things existing out there, but as participating in the revelation, that is, God takes them as witness. The wa, for example, Watin was a tune. The wa in Arabic is by, that is, I take witness. I take these beings as witness. So the world of nature is in a very profound way a witness to the Quranic revelation. And in the deepest sense, you can say that the Quran, like all great revelations from heaven, were revealed not only to humanity, but also to the cosmic ambience in which they lived. That is, through the Quran, these mountains in Mecca became Muslim mountains. It was in 1962, everyone was predicting the end of the world, and because there was a conjunction of all the planets in Aries, which according to Hindu doctrine was the beginning of the Kali Yuga, the age of darkness in which we live, and everybody predicted that would be the end of the Kali Yuga. And so everybody was excited. I happened to be at Harvard at that time, and I was teaching, I was a visiting professor there. I said, oh, I wish I were back in Tehran. And I had a friend who was a very good friend who said, so-and-so, would you rather have a Muslim mountain fall on you rather than a Christian mountain in New Hampshire if the world comes to an end? It was not something completely irrelevant. That is the sense that I speak as a Muslim. I'm sure Hindus are the same for them. The Ganges River is not just a flow of water. It's a sacred, it's a goddess in Hinduism. It's a goddess in which people bathe to purify themselves. The cosmos in which a particular religion is revealed, participates in that revelation. The Prophet of Islam, as seen traditionally, ruled not only over Medina and Mecca, he ruled over the center of the cosmos. The moon seen when he was prophet was seen as being related to the Quranic revelation. And the verse of the Shaq al-Qamar, the cleaving of the moon, which is a very enigmatic verse in the Quran in which the Prophet cleaved the moon, it's the only sort of miracle like that of Christ which we have in Islam. It's very, very significant because it shows this correspondence. Of course, you have equivalents of it in almost all the major religions of the world. And it's not a lecture on comparative religion, so I will not get into that. Another very important point that derives from the participation of the cosmos in revelation is the role played in Islam by nature in the description of paradise. Now the very word, English word paradise, comes from the Pahlavi word, that is Persian language before the rise of Islam, the word paradis. And that word had already entered into Arabic al-Firdaus. And it's one of the words which is the same in English and Arabic for paradise, Firdaus. With the difference that the word paradise does not remind us so much of a garden. Whereas Firdaus in Arabic is the also word for a garden. Paradis in Pahlavi means a garden. Of course, a lot of people say that paradise is nothing but an abstraction of a nice garden by these people who are etherealizing the physical experience. Of course, it's just the other way around. Gardens reflected the garden of paradise. All the traditional people who made gardens consciously, they believed that this the garden reflected paradise. Not paradise simply being a wish on our part to be in a nice garden and therefore we call it garden. So that must be understood. But the actual concrete descriptions of paradise, of Jannah, which also means garden, or Firdaus in the Quran as a paradise, are very close to the world of nature, to the trees, and to water, flowing water, and so forth and so on. And it has a cosmic aspect. Paradise is the spiritual state of blessedness in which we are reunited with nature as God's creation. So nature is not simply deprivation, it's not simply materiality, but it has another level of reality, and the best of us to go to paradise would still be nature. But in nature which is alive. Jalaluddin Rumi, that supreme Sufi poet, has a wonderful verse, which I quote oftentimes. It says, if only things in this world had a tongue, kashti hasti zabani dashti, so that they would lift the veil from all existing things. And he adds that existing things are silent here, but speak in the other world. What he meant was that you see a beautiful flower now in the spring out there. It's silent, but it's speaking a language actually we don't hear. The spiritual person hears that. But in paradise, the flowers speak. That is, the intimacy with nature becomes much greater. Why are we more intimate with our friends than we are with a rock? Because we can speak to the friend. We think we can exchange things. But the rock just sits there. But the rock has its own language. Because it's created by God. And something of the logos, the very principle of creation, is manifested in it. The consequence of this is the Quranic doctrine that all things praise God by that just existing. كُلُّ شَيْءٍ يُسَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِهِ, the Quran says, and comes back to this again and again, that is, existence is the praise of God. And therefore, to destroy anything in nature is to destroy a worshipper, in a certain sense. In Islam, it is said, traditionally, people, thank you very much, have a lot of children. They said, why are you having so many children? They said, because we want to increase the people who say, La ilaha illallah. That's always said. That is a great blessing. That's why a mother who brings children to the world who continue to be traditional is blessed by the fact that she increases the people who say La ilaha illallah. But in a deeper sense, everything says La ilaha illallah through its very existence. Yusabbihu bihamdihi. Everything praises or hymns the praise of God. And therefore, nature is not simply something for us to subjugate, but it participates in our worship on the highest level. It must be treated as friend, as brother and sister, as being almost of the same species. It's not biologically speaking, but metaphysically belonging to the same world as us. Like the American Indians who talk about the nation of birds, the nation of coyote and so forth. They refer to all of the animals as nations, like we refer to France and England as being nations, other human beings living on this side of the Atlantic. Now it's because of this that the Quran refers to Islam, and Islam sees itself as what is called in Arabic Din al-Fatra, the religion of primordiality. The word Fatra appears in the Quran in several different forms. First of all, God is called Fatir as-Samawat wal-Ard, that is the creator of the heavens and the earth. And here the word Fatir is almost equivalent to Khala. But it also means the primordial creator. And therefore the word Fatra, which we have so much trouble in translating into English, F-A-T-R-A-H, Fatra, its closest translation is our primordial nature, primordial reality, the way God created us. And Islam is consciously an attempt to return to the primordial tradition, to go back to the beginning, to go back to the origin. And since the creation, the world of nature, is itself God's first revelation, the attempt of Islam to go back to Deen al-Fitra is also to go back to the bosom of nature. However, it's very difficult to be able to read the pages of the cosmic Quran, that is, as nature, without reading the pages of the Quran as revelation. God has not given us that power. Adam probably did not have a separate book. He who is the first prophet in our anthropology and also Christian anthropology, but the Islam also emphasizes as the first prophet, not only the first man, didn't need a sacred book like Moses had, or Christ, or Prophet of Islam, or other religions have had, because in a sense, nature was his book. That was the book. That was the scripture. And the Deen al-Fitra tries to go back to that reality as something very, very strong in the Quran and in Islam itself, to try to go back to the Deen al-Fitra. Hence, the reduction of all doctrine to supreme simplicity. Rather elaborate, of course, every religion has elaborate doctrines. Islam has produced all kinds of theologians, philosophers, and so forth and so on. They've written 2 million books in Islamic history up to the age of printing. Very bookish civilization. But the heart of the Islamic message is very simple. It's La ilaha illallah. That's it. There is no reality other than God. That's everything is contained therein. And the Islamic rites are simplified and brought close to nature. All Islamic rites have a cosmic dimension in their time. The prayers begin at a certain time, which are not determined by some governmental agency, but by the movement of the sun. The Fajr and so forth and so on, all the way down to the Ashar, to the night prayer. The fasting is determined at the beginning by a cosmic moment, and it ends at a cosmic moment. The Hajj is performed during a particular lunar month, determined not by the Saudi government, but by the movement of the heavens. All Islamic rites are therefore brought back to a kind of closeness to the rhythms of the cosmos. That's for time. As far as space is concerned, nothing is more significant than in this context than realizing that God in a hadith says to the Prophet, "Verily, I have made this earth for thee as a masjid, as a mosque." The word masjid actually comes from the place of sajda, of prostration, since the most humble part and the most profound part, in a sense, of the movements of the Islamic prayers is when we put our forehead on the ground, which is called sajda. The place, mahal name of sajda is masjid. And that is the origin of the English word mosque. So you can prostrate yourself on the earth anywhere. And throughout Islamic history, the nomads in the Islamic world never had a mosque. They never had a building that was called a mosque. Nature was their mosque. And the fact that there were mosques built was because man had already built an urban setting, which was cut off from God's creation. So we needed the mosque. I mean, the mosque, in a sense, the bringing of nature into an artificial ambience that sedentary people have built over the ages, that is, the cities in which we live. Otherwise, there's no need for a mosque. The mosque is not a church. It's not a Hindu temple. It's a very different kind of space. And the space of the mosque, as the late Titus Burckhardt, the remarkable authority on Islamic art, and in Hamdulillah myself, I've written over and over again, the space of the mosque is the continuation of the space of virgin nature. A good mosque is like that. There's no tension. A space that rests upon itself. and reminds us of the proximity of nature. In the Grand Mosque of the Islamic world, light plays a very important role. The wind, the air, birds come in and go out. There is an openness to the natural world. All of these are consequences of the idea that the Islam tried to bring forth of going back to the primordial revelation. And that's why it feels itself so close in many ways to the primal people, to the way the Australian Aborigines or the Zulu or the Sioux of America have looked upon nature as a cathedral. That's a very central idea in Islam and very, very far from the way many people discuss Islam today. Now, to be able to read the message, the actual spiritual message of that first revelation, which is the cosmos, is a very difficult thing. That's why God has sent other revelations. Not because they've improved upon the first revelation, but because we have become more and more closed in upon ourselves and less open to great intuitions, the reception of divine inspiration. That's the reason. The more a person grows thick, you might say, in the head, the more explanation there is needed. And so as humanity gradually fell from seeing the transparency of things, as Adam everywhere, in everything, he saw God, as this became forgotten, revelations had to be sent in order to remind us. And for us who happen to be Muslims, who also respect other revelations, but come before Islam, the Quran is explicit about that, but for us the final revelation is the Quran. The Quran itself is the guide for reading that first cosmic book. Some of the greatest Muslim poets, especially Sufi poets, have written about the shimmering light with its gleams upon the water of a lake, or the beautiful leaves in autumn falling, or the first flowers shooting out of the ground as they're doing now, or the movement of the birds, and so forth and so on. Beautiful so-called nature poetry, which are not nature poetry in the sense of romantic poetry. They're really metaphysical commentaries upon that primordial revelation, which is the cosmos itself. And what one has to learn is to be able to read that primordial book, and that cannot be done with the help of the revelation which God has sent later. The very rare person who in our world can look upon a mountain and read the divine message therein. There are some, but there are very, very few. Primal people have that gift. That's why they did not have a separate revelation. That's the reason. Not that they had no religion. They lived in religion. But nothing named their religion because everything was their religion. And their attitude towards the cosmos was precisely that of the cosmos being the primordial temple. I've said that 100 times, but I need to say it again. Think for a moment that the most beautiful national parks in America, which were set aside first by Theodore Roosevelt and followed by others to protect the pristine virgin nature with a remarkable beauty like Yellowstone National Park or Columbia National Park or Rocky Mountain National Park, all of these, were originally dwelling places of American Indians for God knows how many thousands of years. What commentary does that make? That is where they lived. Yellowstone was the center of American Indian life in Wyoming for God knows how many millennia. But they left it in such a way that the President of the United States was able to claim it as pristine, primordial nature. Very, very difficult from northern New Jersey or Gary, Indiana, or even northern Virginia, many places in this country where we have lived for just a few centuries, not for 10,000 years. So this idea is central, in fact, to Islamic spirituality. Proximity to nature. And a nature which is impregnated by the supernatural. Many Christian theologians in the older days, when they sent missionaries to the Islamic world, they did that also with Hinduism and other religions, but I'm talking only about Islam, claim that the Muslims live in naturalistic religion. They don't have a sense of the supernatural. This was said over and over again. If you go to the library and he studied books sent with him by American missionaries to Beirut or someplace in 1890, or Zwemer and people like that. They always come up with this idea. This is, of course, totally false, but what is true about it is that although Christianity, because of what it had to inherit from the Greco-Roman antiquity, which was a decadent form of idolatry of the cosmos, which is quite something else, drew a very sharp line between the natural and supernatural, in Islam, such a thing does not exist. As I've often said, there's something natural to the supernatural, and something supernatural to the natural. The Arabic word, which corresponds most to the English word grace, which is so central to Christian theology, is by grace that we are saved, is the word baraka. And the word baraka, as I've said, flows through the arteries of the universe. It's everywhere. It's not only in the rites. It's not only in the Quran, as it would be in the Eucharist and Christianity. It is everywhere. Baraka is everywhere. It's like a subtle wind that the eagle is able to find, the wind current, and just hold his wings and fly upward. But that's what baraka is. A person has to learn how to ride on this baraka, that is, to benefit from it. Every act that we do can have baraka if we do it correctly. Everything that we do, from eating, we say the bread is sometimes called baraka in many Islamic languages, the bread itself. Because when we first begin to eat it, when we are hungry, we're eating God's blessing directly. When we are full, we're no longer doing that. That's why we cannot apply an infinite appetite to something finite. That's something else. That's another moral question. But the baraka flows through things, flows through the Quran, through the Arabic language, which is the carrier of the Quran, through when you make the Hajj, the presence of all of these different Islamic rites. But it also flows through beautiful landscape, through natural scenery. And this refusal to separate completely the supernatural and the natural, without denying the supernatural, otherwise, of course, Islam would not be a religion, with emphasizing the absolute transcendence of the divine, which, of course, is supernatural, it's super supernatural, beyond all that forms. This way of looking at things had the deepest effect upon the Muslim manner of living, upon Islamic art, upon city planning, upon Islamic culture, poetry, philosophy, theology, you name it, almost everything, almost everything. And unfortunately, it's when these are lost that to talk about the environmental crisis from the Islamic point of view becomes in a sense meaningless, because we first have to discover what Islam says about the relationship to the world and then talk about these matters. There are many dimensions to this. I will speak only about one before I conclude, because I want to give you a chance to ask questions also. The relation to the animals. Anybody who travels to the Middle Eastern city, Westerners, is struck by the fact that little children run with a stick in their hand to start beating the dogs or something like that. Why are they doing this? They think that Islam has no respect for animals. This is as a sociological reason. When you uproot peasants from the natural ambience that they knew and come and instill them in a city, they cannot create that relationship with the little bit that remains of nature in that city, a tree, let's say, or an animal. In an Islamic village, anywhere in the Islamic world, you'll never see a boy just breaking a branch of a tree. As soon as he comes to a big city, as soon as the municipality plants the tree, it breaks it, and then 1 week is finished. And those who have lived in the Islamic world know what I'm talking about. That is not because of Islam's teaching about animals and plants, but because of what has happened sociologically. As far as Islamic teaching is concerned, just let me say a word about animals and plants and pass it by. That's a vast, vast subject. But first of all, people talk about animal rights right now. Islam teaches animal rights. You might say, well, what about killing animals? Because Muslims are not vegetarians. That killing is done through sacrifice. That is the reintegration of a particular animal into its archetype, into a prototype, as a metaphysical reason. And I've said to my students often, the reason vegetarianism is increasing in the West is that for Christianity, the sacrifice was not of individual animals, that is for Judaism and Islam, or halal meat or kosher meat. but it was done through the sacrifice of Christ. And once one no longer believes in the cosmic sacrifice of Christ for animals, it becomes detestable to eat animals. It sets up a psychological barrier. That's why vegetarianism is spreading, not because people have become serious Hindus or Buddhists. People try to eat themselves to heaven by becoming vegetarians, and in that way that they will enter paradise. I wish that was so easy. It's not. It deals with much more profound principles. So the fact that animals are sacrificed doesn't mean that there was no attention paid to animals. All the animals were always to be taken care of. No animal was to be killed just for the heck of it. Of course, some Muslim kings went on a hunt and killed a deer or something like that, but they were not acting according to Islamic law. All animals that were to be killed were to be killed for food and never in excess. And care for animals was considered to be extremely important. Of course, I'm a cat lover. I have to mention the Prophet loved cats. And he had a cat that I'm sure it went to paradise, as everybody said, that died before the Prophet. And of course, cats are special creatures. I told this story to my class in Man and Environment a short while ago, but I repeat it for you. The great English poetess, Catherine Raine, who died 2-3 years ago, the greatest woman poet of the English language of the 20th century. She and I were very good friends. She was a great cat lover. And I gave a talk in London at the Feminist Academy about 5 years ago, a couple of years before her death, on the issue of spiritual and religious dimension of the environmental crisis. But I also talked about other religions, not like tonight. And she wrote me back, she said, "Dr. Nares, was so wonderful, your lecture. Of course, you should have brought out more that nature has fallen. It's not as it was in paradise. And you should have remembered that, of course, everything has fallen except the cat." So the love of that the Islamic world for the cat is something very special. But also other animals, even the fact that they said Muslims don't like dogs, that's not at all true. They don't like Napoleonic little puppies that are kept. I say Napoleonic because when Napoleon went to war in Germany, the wives of many of his officers began to have affairs. So he ordered the wives of all higher officers of the French army to carry poodles with them. And so it was a law. And it became fashionable for Frenchmen to carry poodles, and it got on from there to become what it is today. In Islam, of course, dogs are seen as protectors, as playing a very important guardian role. All shepherds have dogs and so forth and so on. And other creatures, birds, I don't want to go into that. The first document we have of a kind of environmental debate between human beings and animals, each asking for their rights before the king of the jinn, as it happened in a sense before a spiritual authority, comes from the Islamic civilization. It was written over 1,000 years ago on the confrontation between man and the animals, which was translated into Hebrew and translated into Latin. And now there are 2 English translations of it. It's out. Everybody had forgotten it until I rediscovered this when I was writing my thesis in the 50s at Harvard. And I wrote a whole section on it, my thesis dealing with concept of nature and cosmology in the Islamic world. So there's a whole vast literature of how to treat animals. Animals have their rights according to Islamic law. And if people don't pay attention to it, that's why many people don't pay attention to Islamic law about drinking, and they drink. And that doesn't mean it's not part of Islamic law. The two should not be confused. And also this uprooting has taken place in the Islamic world. The flow of a large number of peasants and nomadic people into big cities, and their dislocation vis-a-vis the world of nature that surrounded them, plays a very, very important role. Now, let me conclude. My time is up. By first of all saying, repeating for you, the key for the understanding of the cosmos, the ayat, which are cosmic, are the ayat of the Quran. And the key for the understanding of the ayat of the Quran are being able to read the ayat within ourselves. The Quran is, first of all, a guide for our knowledge of ourselves. It is only through the self-knowledge that a profounder relationship can be created with the cosmos. One of the criticisms that I've been making for 4 decades against the modern environmentalist movement is lack of attention to this point. those people who go and tie themselves to trees and so forth, they will not be cut down. They're very precious. They're really heroes. I have the greatest respect for them. But unless we pay attention to the within world, that problem is never going to be solved. As soon as the girl goes home, they will come with electric saws and cut the tree down, as they've done a billion times. Now, today in the Islamic world, there's no greater need than to resuscitate this vision, which I tried to summarize for you. During the last 20 years, fortunately, as a result of a few people like myself shouting away, there's a great deal of interest now in Saudi Arabia even, in Islamic law pertaining to nature. The Prophet created a harem, an area in the center of Saudi Arabia where the holy cities of Islam are created, placed, where it was forbidden to kill animals and to cut plants. And this being used actually in many Islamic countries. I know in Nigeria, in Saudi Arabia, people talk about it in Pakistan, in many places, as a basis for a kind of environmental law which would create certain areas which would be forbidden to any kind of exploitation of nature. There are also a lot of discussions of applying Islamic law explicitly to the non-human world, not only metaphysically as I did, but explicitly, and expanding that, although there are laws explicitly, all the way from this fact that you cannot even sacrifice an animal without giving it a drink. But the drink is considered to be a way in which the soul of the animal is pacified as it returns back to its archetype. Of course, you might say, why don't all Muslims become vegetarians? The people of Tibet were Tibetan Buddhists. They're not vegetarians because there are no vegetables in Tibet. You live with a yak or you disappear. The Tibetan plateau would not have been occupied, but populated without the yak being eaten and this milk being used. They even use it in tea, oh God. You know, yak butter on top of tea, and we don't like it very much. But that's the reason. And the Islamic world, environmentally, ecologically, it could not have been otherwise. It's different from India, where out of every wall they shoot 20 plants. You can just pick up your... used to be in the old days, just pick up fruit and eat it as you walked out of Delhi. Of course, that's not the same Delhi anymore, but that ambience, the cosmic ambience in which Islam grew, did not permit that. But that did not mean this very great respect for the sanctity of life, and not only human life. And now people are trying to expand that. There are a number of jurists throughout the Islamic world who are working on this. One of them did a PhD with me here some years ago, just at GW, who is now back in Nigeria. And this is not my field. I do not usually deal with it. I'm not a jurist. I'm not a lawyer. But I just want to mention to you that this is being done. But more than that, there needs to be a revision in the sense of revision, going back to a vision of the cosmos in which we see the cosmos not only as God's creation out there, but the reflection of our deepest selves and our role as the Khalifatullah, the vicegerents of God, who protects his own creation, to create creation, to preserve creation. We are, otherwise, we're not his Khalifa. And most of all, to realize what no Muslim government, no American government, no French government realizes, that ecocide is suicide. That is, in killing nature, ecocide means killing ecosystems. You're really committing suicide. And while we're doing it, we're talking about everything else except this act of committing suicide. But Islam can contribute to this discussion, as can also Hinduism and Taoism, two of the other great traditions of Asia. It is still living metaphysics of nature, a very rich philosophical and metaphysical tradition, which has to be brought out through archaeology. It does also exist in the West. It's deeply hidden in many treasures and needs a lot of archaeological digging. Whereas in the Islamic world, it is part and parcel of everyday culture. And for that reason, I will end my lecture with a poem of the most famous poet of the Persian language. I think the best was Hafiz, but Sa'di, the famous poet Sa'di, upon his poetry, the whole of Asia, Islamic Asia, has been brought up for the last 700 years. And I'll recite this in Persian for you until the end, but this is the Persian New Year, and I'll hear one Persian poem. So Sa'di said, "Bijahan khurram azana, ki jahan khurram azust. Aashiqam barhame alam, ki hame alam azust." says, I'm joyous in the world, for the world belongs to him. I به جهان خرم از آنم که جهان خرم از اوست. عاشقم بر همه عالم. I'm in love with the world because all the world belongs to God as the ultimate lover. Thank you. Yes, I'll sit there. It's supposed to be very bad for my heart to stand up and give lectures, and I've had a heart operation, but I don't listen to the doctors because it's our chance to report on the U.S. president and put chew gum and walk at the same time. I'm prepared to stand up and speak after all these years. I can't sit down and lecture. Well, but I'll answer the question from here.
Anyway, jazakallah, Dr. Nasser, for your very insightful lecture. At this time, I'd like to begin a 5-minute question and answer session. Please raise your hand and I'll call on you.
They're listening to the silence. This is with nature.
We're talking about how the...
Hey, why don't you come here so everybody can hear the question? Because I really have no answer. Stand there. Anybody who wants to ask a question, please,
either
speak very loudly or come here.
You were talking about how all of nature is a symbol of God. And what we have with modern science is very good at studying nature at the level at which it chooses to study it. But it's destroying all these symbols. So is there any kind of revival of symbolism based on the fact that modern science is presenting today?
That's a very good question. Anything that corresponds to any aspect of reality is ultimately symbolic to the extent that it is related to reality. So yes, quantum mechanics has certain symbolic aspects to it. But in order to understand that, you need to know metaphysics. But that itself is rejected by modern scientists. It's as scientists, there are certain people. Our mutual friend Wolfgang Smith has written this incredible book, The Quantum Enigma, which he brings out the metaphysical and symbolic understanding of quantum mechanics. But he cannot do that as a physicist. He's doing that as a mathematician physicist who is also a metaphysician and theologian. But modern science does not allow itself to be integrated into a symbolic perspective, into a higher understanding, which would not destroy its understanding on its own level, but which destroy its claim to absoluteness, the totalitarian absoluteness. It guards that in every way that it can. That's why the problem is so difficult. Yes?
Please.
Dr. Lombard, go ahead.
Thank you. Given that...
The study was years and years doesn't ask any questions.
I think I know the answer to this, so I'm going to ask anyways. But given that the vast majority of people are not actually metaphysicians and are not going to necessarily understand things in a metaphysical framework, and that probably even fewer people can afford to build a passive solar house that's completely off the grid and buy their Toyota Prius, what would you recommend that people do on a more practical basis? How can something be achieved based on these principles?
This is a very good question. I will answer it, and that will end the session because it needs 2-3 minutes to answer your question. No change ever comes about en masse. When Galileo and Kepler and Newton were changing the whole world view of the West, there were no more than 50 people in the whole of the West already at the frontiers of what was going on. 99.9% of Western people still followed the Christian view of nature. Just those few people were able to bring about gradually, step by step, all the changes which we observe now. Even now, they've not brought up 100% change, because still there are some Christians who pray for rain. The drought that you have in southwestern United States, have all these prayer sessions. So which means that's very anti-scientific, but nevertheless, they still have some belief in the way that God is related to the cosmos. Now, if there's going to be any solution, it cannot come from below. The people who drive hammers have not invented hammers. How the hammer comes to use 1 gallon to 6 miles is through a series of events which has led to this. And you cannot start from below. That's the major difference with Al Gore, who's a very good friend of mine. We've spoken oftentimes about this together. By simply having Priuses and gradually bringing hummers out of the market and have everybody drive a Prius and have solar house, that's wonderful. But that will give us 10 more years to think of real solutions, no more than that. I believe the solution can only come with the change of our vision of reality and how we fit into the world and the revival of the spiritual perspective of nature. Nothing else, I think, will do it. Unfortunately, I think before we have several centuries for that to percolate in reverse as the mechanical view of the 17th century percolated into society, we're going to have cataclysmic crises. And people often ask me, what is the solution? I say the best possibility is a catastrophe. Not a catastrophe which would kill the whole of humanity, that would be big enough so people would stop wasting and would not consider waste as part of life. Happiness is to buy. Consumerism, all of these things, would come to an end just like that. If people realize there's a matter of life and death. The fact that today you have two parties debating every issue except the most important issue on the earth, I'm talking about the American political process right now, is devastating, absolutely devastating. It's a little bit better than 20 years ago. At least they say, yes, I'm preventing global warming. But let's go to more important issues of what somebody's husband or wife did to somebody else or something like that. Those are the major issues of the day. And therefore, I think we don't have time for that process. But nevertheless, restitution always begins from the top. It's always the few who guide the many. There has been no exception in human history. Whether it's religious, whether the Buddha began all by himself under the Bodhgaya tree in Benares. And now, 2,500 years later, half of Eastern Asia are his followers. Or, in the other realm, the secularization of the cosmos, which we see in the 17th century, which begins with so few people. It's astounding. People think of, everybody in England and Italy were following Galileo or Newton. Not at all. There were few people in the Royal Israeli Society, few people in the Lecce Academy in Italy, and a few other people in France, and were corresponding with each other in Germany. We would add them all up, less than the number of people in the show. So that is the reality of it. You've never had a historical process of the profound change of paradigm and worldview, which has started with buying a Priuses from below. It started with a change of worldview, change of heart. And change of mind depends on a change of heart. And that's why all people talk about paradigms, paradigm shifts, conferences held, they're never going to get anywhere. And this is a change of heart. We begin to have a new vision of who we are, where we live, what are we doing here, what is our responsibility, what are human rights, but most of all, what are God's rights and the rights of nature. That's all I will say. No.